Hey, good morning to everyone. We'll be starting today's class on the question of the equality between Gentiles and Jews. Just in a few minutes. And if there's any part of the class that you missed, if you come in late, we do record the classes and post them on the audio link on our website. So you can go there and listen to it in its entirety. And we will be referring to sources in the Torah and Maimonides and a question that was raised this past week regarding if there is equality, why is there a certain limitation by one of the rabbis on the performance of a few of the Torah laws for Gentiles? Why is there not complete equality in terms of the fulfillment of the laws as well, if there is equality in terms of our nature as human beings? So we'll take that up once we do some opening remarks. And again, once again, when you hear the audio stream, just type audio okay at the bottom of the screen. That'll confirm for us that you're picking up the audio properly. And again, we will start in just a few moments. At certain intervals throughout the class, we will have questions. So we'll pause from our end so you can think about the question and respond by typing it at the bottom of your screen. Okay, thank you, Rick and Susan in Seattle. Okay, thank you for the confirmation. And the sources that we will address today in Maimonides and the Rambam is going to be his Laws of Kings and also Laws of Tefillin. Okay, Rebecca in Seattle, thank you. Tzvi, thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning, Rabbi. How are you?
Good. Good morning, Doug. How are you?
Excellent. Thank you.
Good. Well, you know, I did some research. I actually had a discussion. I spent a Shabbos over by Rabbi Mann, so we discussed your question about mezuzah, so we'll take that up.
Oh, excellent. Thank you. Bill, is that you?
Yes, Doug. How are you?
Excellent. How about yourself?
Just fine. Good morning, Rabbi.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine. Thank you.
Okay. Cal, how are you? Good. Rabbi Mann actually had a response on your question on the Radvaz, but I'll present it in sequence. I just wanted to give a couple of opening remarks and some sources just to set the tone, and then we'll go to both Laws of Kings in Maimonides, and then we'll go to Laws of Tefillin, where he talks about we'll have to make a distinction between who is fit for writing tefillin, and not even all Jews are fit to do it, and also mezuzah and sefer Torah. Those three are all areas where God's name is written. So there's a very interesting insights that we will find today. Okay, so let's commence. I just want to start by, you know, just addressing the basic question of whether there is full equality between Gentile and Jew, and the answer is yes, there is complete equality. We've said a number of occasions. And how does it sound, by the way, over there, Doug, Cal, Bill?
Hello, fine.
Sounds good? Okay, good. Okay, so on a number of occasions, we've cited sources in the Torah. It says, for example, in Numbers 15:16, that there is one Torah for both the convert and the Jew. So that means the person who is not born Jewish converts. There's no distinction in terms of the Torah laws that he follows. And nothing changed in terms of the design of the convert when he converted. So we were forced to say that the ability for the convert to follow the same laws as the Jew shows that even before he converted, he had the same capacity. And this is also stated again in Exodus 12:49. This is the same thing again, that there's one law for the convert and the Jew. So these are God's words, and all the statements that there are superiority in the Jew are completely false. They're baseless. It really stems just from an ignorant arrogance, and it's not something which God states at all. And of course, we know that God created man only once, and everybody that exists today, regardless of what type of religious lifestyle the parents lead, we're all the same exact design, physically, psychologically, emotionally. So we have to be honest when we approach any area and use our intelligence, and the truth will be discovered. If we have no agendas but perceiving exactly how the universe works, we will see the truth. Okay. Now, of course, there are different, there's a different role that the Jew has, but that's a designation. That does not mean there's any change in the design of the Jew. It's merely a designation that the Jew has since Abraham was able to extricate himself from idolatry. I mean, Abraham was no more Jewish than the sinful inhabitants of Sodom that God destroyed. Everybody stemmed from Adam, so everybody shared the same design. Abraham was a brilliant individual and was able to discover that the idolatrous cultures were completely wrong, using his intelligence alone, and then finding God. And he raised himself to such a level that God spoke to him. That's a tremendously high level. Without any teacher, without any books, he was able to do this. That shows you the great capacity of the human intelligence. That a person can find proofs and reason and even be entitled that the creator of the universe will talk to him. And God then set him up to be the leader of the nation, which we refer to as the children of Israel, Jews. But that was only because a designation was given to him, since he and his son Isaac and his grandson Jacob were following and supporting and teaching true ideas and dispelling fallacy about idolatry and polytheism, detheism, and all these different forms of fantasy life. So it's clear that there's no difference in design between a person who's born to Jewish parents or a person who's born to non-Jewish parents. And the truth is the benefit is the same in terms of whether the person is born Jewish or converts. And we see that the Torah says openly that there is one Torah for both the convert and the Jew. And again, the seven Noahide laws are merely a minimal system, as Rabbi Chait explained. They're not a system of perfection. It's just a minimal entitlement to keep life. That's why if any one of the seven Noahides are broken, so then the person is killed. Because it has to be if a person can't even keep the minimal set of laws to entitle you to life, so then the person forfeits their life. Okay. Now, having said that, we also see, just another support for the equality is that we know the famous story of Ruth, who converted to Judaism, and her children, King David and King Solomon, were the greatest leaders, the greatest minds, and also the Messiah comes from Ruth. So we see that God has no favorites when it comes to individuals. It depends on the person's perfection. So we say that perfection is not a Jewish birthright. It is a human accomplishment, if we want to really say it succinctly. Okay. Now, having said that, Doug Taylor had a question regarding a statement of Maimonides and a commentary by Radvaz. I'll read it to you. This is in Laws of Kings, Chapter 10, Law 10. And it states as follows. A Noahide that desires to keep any mitzvah besides his seven in order to receive reward, meaning he's not doing it as a command because he's not commanded in it. The only time he's commanded in the other laws is if he becomes a Jew. So then the other laws are commanded to him. But if he wants to keep the other ones in the capacity of perfecting himself, then Maimonides says we do not hold them back from doing it exactly as the Torah says it should be done. So he does it properly. Okay. So this makes sense, because he's going to gain the same perfection as a Jew will, because there's the same capacity intelligently and emotionally as a Jew with, same exact design. So the question comes up that the commentator, the Radvaz, says that nonetheless, regarding the laws the laws that require kedusha, which means sanctity, and tahara, which could either mean pure or in a physical sense, or it could be pure in terms of the spiritual sense. So he says laws that require these two things, sanctity and purity, for example, tefillin, or sefer Torah, or mezuzah. He says, I am hesitant, but I am more stringent, and I don't feel that we should allow somebody who's not Jewish to do these three. So the question is, if we're saying that both Jew and Gentile are equal in design and capacity for perfection, so what is Radvaz's statement over here, that he feels that he's hesitant, but he says that he wants to lean to be more strict, and at least only these three, all right, the mezuzah and the tefillin, the black boxes that have the parchment with God's name and sections of the Torah written inside. The mezuzah also has two sections of the Torah written inside. And, of course, the Torah itself has God's name. So he says because of the aspect of they require. So he says these mitzvos that require sanctity and purity. So he says I hesitantly or am more stringent on these. So he doesn't say that he's absolutely sure, but he says you should lean towards be more strict on that. And he says because of those reasons of sanctity. So I was discussing this with Rabbi Reuven Mann over Shabbos, and he felt that it was more very straightforward. That he said that, and it's a good answer, that since there is a level of a higher level of regard that you have to have with these objects, with tefillin, the mezuzah, and the Sefer Torah, the Torah scroll, so therefore somebody who's not accustomed to keeping all the laws, like a Jew, is not going to have the right type of behavior and the way he will relate to these objects is not going to be on par with what's demanded. Just to give you an example, we know that God's name is never erased except, from when we have a parchment, God's name, so erasing God's name is a sin. And taking God's name in vain, it's one of the Ten Commandments, is a sin. You're not allowed to do that. And we have to treat things with God's name with sanctity. For example, if a Torah is dropped in the temple, or if my tefillin, when they're unwrapped or they're not in the sack, if they're dropped, a person has to fast for a day because of the level of sanctity, because of God's name. So this is what I want to get to in a bit and see if we can now just break this up more by looking at what Maimonides says in the laws of tefillin, where he talks about this a little bit more. But just in terms of Rabbi Mann's approach, he's just showing that since there the Noachad is only keeping seven or a few, or maybe a dozen or a few dozen laws, whichever ones he's keeping, and everything that goes along with the Noachad lifestyle, it still is not the same level of adherence where a Jew is keeping a few hundred. I mean, a Jew's not going to be able to keep all 613 for various reasons. If a person's not married, so he can't fulfill the laws of divorce, and so on. If a person's not a priest, he can't take care of, he can't address the laws, fulfill the laws that address the priest. Okay. Now, let's take a look. All right, so far so good. Any questions at this point?
No, except that if there is a certain, Radvaz implies there needs to be a certain level of sanctity and purity, but it's my understanding that any Jewish person is open to do those. And so if someone is not keeping all the mitzvot, or maybe not keeping hardly any of them, how does that work with regard to his concern about a certain level of holiness and purity?
Well, Rabbi Mann also addressed that, is that once we have the group the Jew now has, it's meaning anybody who's a Jew, even if he's not keeping all the laws, he's not religious, but since he is not, the law is relegated to the Jew and not to the Ben Noach, so now even though you can have a Ben Noach that is much more perfected than a Jew, but we have standards in terms of keeping the law intact. So it was given to a group. So even though, I mean, if you're asking that, how could it be that a Jew would be allowed to keep mezuzah and all that if he's not following the rest of the Torah system, right?
Right.
Right. So, nonetheless, the law does apply to the Jew as the right individual and abstract. And it's true, in specific, you'll have people that really aren't fit, but you can't have the law that way. The law has to be relegated to the Jew, and a Jew is defined by coming from parents that are Jewish. Even though we could have one Jew that's 60 years old and never kept anything, and you can have a Ben Noach who's been practicing the Noahide laws and perfection and working on himself his entire life, nonetheless, according to Radvaz, because we have to have a certain structure to law, so the category is that the Ben Noach, he said he leans to be stringent, that he shouldn't take on these three laws, and the Jew can. But that's not a reflection on the individual. It's a reflection on the standards that a halacha has to have. Otherwise, you can't have a system if you have exceptions all across the board. Okay?
Thank you.
Okay, sure. All right. So now let's get a little bit more of an insight into the Radvaz. And Rabbi Mann went even so far to say that he doesn't even feel Radvaz is necessarily arguing with Maimonides. He feels maybe Maimonides is just giving the broad strokes, but there is room in Maimonides' words that Radvaz would fit, that even Maimonides would agree. All right, so that's something to be discussed. But now we just want to get more of an insight into what is the nature of these, the Torah, the mitzvah, the mezuzah, and the tefillin. So let's take a look at the laws of tefillin in the Maimonides. Now, first off, his first law, he states, let me see where it is. See, not the first law. He talks in Laws of Tefillin, Chapter 1, Law 13. So he says as follows, a Torah or Tefillin or Mezuzah that's written by a heretic, denies God. So those objects have to be burned. Even though it has God's name on it, in ink, we look at it, it looks just like a Sefer Torah that a rabbi wrote or a Jew wrote. Right? Nonetheless, since it was written by a heretic, an apikoros, so it has to be burnt. If it was written by a kusi, which Rabbi Mann explained was a person who is not Jewish, he accepts one God, but he says that God is worshipped by serving other deities. So his concept of God is intact, but the way you worship God is where the corruption is. That's the difference between saying there are two gods. The person who thinks God is two, so that's the apikoros. That would be a person that has a wrong concept of God. So there's a difference between saying what God is or what God's will is. That's the Rebbe Mann statement. I have to think of that more in terms of how we can, more fine-tune it. But nonetheless, there is a difference, because if a heretic wrote a Torah, or a tefillin or mezuzah, so you have to burn it. It has no value, it has to be destroyed. If, however, a kusi, right, or an Israelite who is a mummer, meaning he defects on even one law, he just says, I'm not going to keep this one law. He makes it not a person who accidentally sins, but a person says, all right, I am not keeping a certain law. That's a mummer, right, or a woman, or a katan, a woman or a child. And the reason why they can't write it, and he says all these people that he's grouping in the second category, the Torah is pasul. I mean, you can't use it to read from, but you don't burn it. You store it away. So that means it's not something which is as negative as a person who's a heretic. But the reason why it says woman and child is because they're ideas of God have not matured yet, since they are not commanded in study. Okay? Not because they don't have the capacity, just because they didn't have the experience of the study yet. And what does he bases this on? He says, as it states in the Torah, the reason for this law. It says in the Torah, ukashartim, ukasaftim, and you should bind them, meaning referring to the tefillin, you should bind them on your arms, and you should write them. So he says, anybody who is commanded, who is warned on the binding of the tefillin, and believes in them, he is the one that is he is the one alone that is fit for writing them. So he says, those who are commanded in keeping the law are the ones that are commanded in writing it. Okay, but you see, he adds in umam, that then they also believe it, meaning they are the ones, anybody who is commanded on the binding of the tefillin and in believing them, meaning, what do you mean, you don't believe in tefillin, you believe in the concepts that are written inside the tefillin. That means to say that it's not sufficient just that you write it, that you have to have a conviction in the ideas, which is a very interesting point, and we'll elaborate. Okay, he says further in Law 15, he says, a person who writes a Sefer Torah or Tefillin or Mezuzah, and when he's writing, he does not have intent, and he writes one of God's names, not with the right idea of God, it's null, null and void.
Rabbi, can I ask a question?
Yes, go ahead.
When it comes to statements like doesn't have the intent, how is it determined that he has an intent or he doesn't have an intent?
He's the only one that could determine that. Okay? And somebody's just writing on screen, they want to know. It's Mike USA is asking why you stating that Maimonides' word is law. He says the Torah is law, not Maimonides. Well, Mike, you should know that the Shulchan Aruch, where we get Jewish law from, is written by Joseph Cairo and primarily based on Maimonides' words. So we're going right to the source. You can either read the Shulchan Aruch, which is largely codified based on Maimonides, or we could read Maimonides himself. So when you're saying that Maimonides' word is not Torah, that's incorrect. He was one of the greatest minds. And all Torah is received today and that we follow today is based on the who we call the Rishonim, the first Torah transmitters. So reading Maimonides is definitely in line with saying that that Maimonides' word is Torah. Okay. I mean, there may be points where we don't follow Maimonides in specific cases, or maybe in a lot of cases, but to say that Maimonides is not Torah is not correct. If you want to say that it's in terms of what we follow Torah law, you're right. We go to the Shulchan Aruch. Okay. Hope that clears it up. Now, so now we see that the second law, which is in Laws of Tefillin, Chapter 1, Law 15, he says, if a person does not have intent when he writes down any of God's names, so then it's puzzle, it's null. And it doesn't have any value. And he says, therefore, if you're writing a Sefer Torah, and in the midst of doing this, a king or a president comes over to you and starts talking to you, you're not allowed to respond. You have to keep your intent on writing God's name, and that's it. Okay, so now we see that the Torah, or the mezuzah, the tefillin, is not necessarily just the written object. It's not the skin with the black ink. That is not what defines it. It's defined by the intent of the writer at the time that he's writing it. So although physically it looks identical to if we have one person that has no idea of God, he writes a Torah, and then you have a person who knows what God is to the best of human capacity, and then now we have two Torahs, they look identical. One of them is completely not a Torah, and one of them is. So we see that what defines the Torah and the mezuzah and tefillin as actual objects of law, as a mitzvah, as an object of a mitzvah, is defined by intent as well, ideas. So we see how ideas surpass the physical world. Okay? Which makes sense if you think about it, because, just take it slow, when let's say, for example, you think about the idea of a triangle. So a triangle can be drawn many different ways. You have longer sides than the other ones, two sides are long, an isosceles triangle, or two equal sides and one is different. You could have them written in different colors, different type of materials, they can be carved in stone, but they all share a triangle. I mean, the concept of the triangle is really what defines what triangle is, not the physical expression. Same thing in terms of with God's creation of the world, that we say that the rabbis say, actually, that God looked at the Torah and created the world. Histakel ba'araisa ubara alma. That's in Aramaic. God stared at the Torah and he created the world, which means to say that the world is subsequent. The expression of what the world is for is really to follow ideas, the goal. And that goal meaning that the human beings that can be cognizant and study and God and his ways. So that's why we say that what defines reality most is, again, I mean, before the world existed. So God existed before everything, we say. Therefore, that which is not physical is superior to that which is physical. So also when we're talking about a Sefer Torah or a mezuzah or a tefillin, the idea that you have about something is really more important than the thing itself. Rashi himself, Rabbi Chait said once that he says, I think in Deuteronomy, that if a person does a command but has no concept of what he's doing, so then it's useless. Because it's the idea that arrives in his mind which is really the objective. It's the soul which has the higher level of importance in our life than our physical existence. And that's why we say the true existence of man is not on earth, it's after he separates from the body. So here also, when we're talking about the construction of a recognized Torah or tefillin or mezuzah, so that is defined by the idea, not the physical thing. You could have two things which look identical, one is considered a Torah, one is not. But you see that the important thing is the essential element of Torah is God's name. And as we said before, there's a tremendous amount of respect and behavior that we have to relegate ourselves to in connection with God's name. If the Torah is dropped, so the whole that whole temple that's there in the room when it's dropped has to fast a day. And also if a person drops this tefillin and they're not wrapped up, he has to fast. Why? Because in both of these objects, God's name is written. So that we have to recognize that the Torah is trying to target a great respect to God at every single turn. So all the laws that we have and all the ideas that we derive from them are to give us a greater appreciation, an ever-growing appreciation for God being the Creator, and that we should be contemplating this. It used to be in the old days that they wore tefillin all day long. And a person had to be, and we'll see in Maimonides how he says this, that a person had to be contemplating the tefillin while they were on his body the whole day. He could not take his mind off of them. That's an amazing level, to be focused on the tefillin the whole time they were on. And Maimonides says, therefore, a person has to move the tefillin. He has to touch the tefillin on his head and on his arm to be cognizant of them. Okay. All right. Now let me just take a
question on that. I know on the ultra orthodox, you tell me where the tzitzit on the outside of the garments.
Yeah.
Correct? And then a lot of other, for instance, Orthodox Jews, sometimes they don't wear the tzitzit on the outside. They may wear the tzitzit on the inside. Is there any issue regarding whether or not one is the right way or one is the wrong way in that regard, or is it just a matter of practice or custom?
Well, it would appear that since the tzitzis are, that says that you should look at them and you should remember the laws, so it makes sense that you shouldn't have them in a way which is completely concealed the whole day. It makes sense that they should be some sort of an apparent fashion. Wearing them completely out is clearly better because you have more opportunity to see them. Is it a law to wear them out? Not that I know of. But if you conceal them the entire day, so then you're not giving yourself the opportunity to gain from what they're for.
Okay. And if the tzitzit is worn on, it has to be in a four-cornered garment, correct?
Yes.
So if a person chooses not to wear a four-cornered garment, then there's no obligation to wear the tzitzit.
That's one view. Another view is that you have to make sure that you don't abandon that law. So we'd forcibly, like today, we wear it as a custom. And but we put a talus on in the morning, which is four corners, in order to make sure that we're fulfilling that law.
Okay.
So it's a good custom because, theoretically, with today's fashion styles, it's theoretically possible never to fulfill that law. And since it is a perfection, we'd be losing out a great deal by not having it.
Thank you.
Okay. And let me just take a few questions here online. Jerry in Kentucky is asking, if he says one Torah for all, then should there not be one Torah for all? Well, there is, Jerry, for one Torah in terms of both the Noahide and the Jew. The Noahide has seven minimum laws, and the Jew has 613. And we can go, the reason why there's only seven minimums is because God set up the system that the Jew is now the teachers and delivers it to the rest of the world and makes it available to everybody. And it definitely, again, it is better for an individual that's keeping more, but that's something which you're not obligated in. Okay, Abraham was the one that had led the way, and God said, now since you've perfected yourself this far, I'm going to create in you a leader, a light unto nations. I'm going to create you to be the teachers. So the system is truly for everybody, but it's an individual choice in terms of Ben Noach. And Rosora is asking, since the correct intent is only known by the writer. So now we're going back to the main point. The main point we're just discussing again is that the written, God's name was written, has to have the right intent. Okay, so Rosora is asking, since the correct intent is only known by the writer, it is probable that he will not admit it. So the importance of this concept is to show the importance of ideas and not to determine the validity of a particular instance of Torah. Yes, we're not trying to say which Torah at this point. Well, I mean, we are defining, Rosora, what exactly makes a valid Torah. We are saying that it depends on the intent. Our question right now is, did a certain individual in specific have the intent? No, we're talking in general right now that this is what's required. Okay, that's the point. The point is what is required, and we're just trying to show how the right concept of God is necessary. And at the time of writing also. So it's not just a physical object that is a valid Torah, a valid tefillin, or a valid mezuzah. It only becomes valid if there was the right concept of God when that God's name was written. Let's do a couple more laws just to get more of a feel for Maimonides here. Okay, for example, here's another law, which is Tefillin, the laws of Tefillin, chapter 4, law 9. He says, a vessel that you prepared to place your Tefillin inside, and you use it for the Tefillin, now becomes sanctified. Interesting. So not only the Tefillin, the Mezuzah, and the Sefer Torah have a status of sanctity, we have to treat it a certain way, as opposed to other objects that don't have God's name, although the other objects of mitzvah do have a certain level of sanctity, whereas opposed to a mundane object. Let's say, for example, an apple. So I could take an apple and throw it. It's not an object of a command. However, a lamp that I use for the Hanukkah candles, that I have to treat the lamp a certain way because it's something used for mitzvah. Then you have a higher level of like, for example, Maimonides says that the tefillin, person has to make sure, this is now law, it's 4:14 in laws of tefillin. He says a person is obligated to move around, to feel his tefillin the whole time that they are resting on him, that he should not remove his mind from them, even for one moment. Why? Because the sanctity is a great sanctity. even more than the gold plate that the high priest wore on his forehead that said "Holy to God." In Hebrew, it said "Kadosh LaHashem." So you would think that something which is used in the temple, the golden head plate that had the words "Holy to God" that the high priest wore, you'd think that that would be something on a higher level than tefillin that everybody wears. No, he says just the opposite. The tefillin are much more sanctified because the gold head plate only has God's name once, whereas the tefillin have God's name 23 times on the tefillin of the head and another 23 times in the tefillin of the arm. So now you see clearly he spells out that the status of sanctity is relegated to these objects due to the amount of times of God's name, the more times God's name is in something. So even the higher level of sanctity. Okay, and it's important to know the concept of God's name as well, as Rabbi Shay explained, that we don't know, we cannot know what God is. That's what God said to Moses. Moses wanted to know God's true nature, and God said to Moses, "You cannot know me while you're alive, while you're physical." So that's why we say in all our prayers that we bless God's name. We keep on saying bless God's name because we don't know what God is. Essentially, we don't know his true nature. We only have his name. That's the closest thing. So therefore, we bless God's name. We say we're blessing his name to show that I don't know what he is. I can't say I bless God because I'm not able to know what God's nature is. So therefore, we see how the name of God takes on what we have to treat with this respect, because at the same time that we're treating it with respect, we're admitting another idea, which is a beautiful concept, that when we say we're praising God's name, we are praising God, and at the same time we're admitting ignorance of what God's nature is, because we could only say we're praising his name. So we're praising him to remind ourselves of how great this creator is, that he put this entire universe into existence from nothingness. I mean, this is mind-boggling. We don't know how he's able to do this. It just is amazing, the expanse of the billions of galaxies and the trillions of miles of space and the size and the perfection of all the laws and how the Earth is just the right distance away from the sun, not further away, not closer. It would have been either too cold or too hot, and the atmosphere and everything that goes into the Earth and biology and all sciences, we're just amazed, and scientists are just taken back at the tremendous amount of laws that we see in the Earth. So we are totally amazed, and we have this need, we have this, and it's like perfection that we praise God because we're just in awe of what he did. At the same time, we have to stop and say it's only his name that we can praise because we don't know what he is, essentially. Okay, and Alberto is asking a question. He says, even his name should be considered no name at all, since he is not physical. Even the concept of a name is not applied to him. Or no. No, the name is. That's something which we have the ability to do. We have a reference, because even the name of God has meaning. Okay, that gives us concept that he always exists. One of the names of God is that he always existed, past, present, and future, in terms of our world. There's other names of God, like Master, Ado, and then the word, and then Noi. So if a person says that name, he's referring to another attribute. But truthfully, it's only to us that there's different attributes, that he's kind, that he is just. Because we have a limited way of referring to God, but that's all we have. Okay. Now, so it's important to see that when we're talking about the level of importance to these objects, that which is an object of just mundane use, like an apple or my car keys, that I can treat any way I want. There's no importance to them. A object used for a Torah law, that's even higher. And an object that has God's name written properly, that's even higher. And that's all to target in man what he should have the most respect for. And the reason why we have to have respect is, again, not that God needs any respect for man. That's a ridiculous idea. God has no needs. But the respect that we're giving is in order that we constantly reiterate in our minds on a daily basis what is the focal point of our life. Okay. And Mike had one more question. You're asking, shouldn't one refer to the Torah instead of referring to the famous rabbis' interpretations of the Torah? Well, that's not true. God himself said that you should, it's Deuteronomy 17:11, that God says that in accordance with the Torah that the rabbis teach you, you should follow. You should not veer, you know, to the right or to the left. So God himself sanctions and endorses man's adherence to the rabbi's words. God wants us to study from the rabbis. So that's God's will, Mike. Okay, that doesn't mean that the rabbi is always right. I mean, we know clearly every person makes mistakes, even Moses. But God wants that the transmission of Torah is something which is based on intelligence, and that is echoed by the fact that we follow the rabbis. I mean, the concept of prophecy as well teaches us that when the prophet comes and tells the Jews something, that now awakens us, of course, to what the communication is. But now we realize that the prophet is somebody who was able to get the prophecy. Why? Because he is somebody who raised himself to a higher level of his intelligence. So prophecy endorses man's action of using intelligence, because a prophecy does not come to somebody who is ignorant or doesn't train his mind. Okay. All right, let me pause here, see if there's any questions or comments at this point. Are we good over there, Doug? Red?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. All right. All right, now just to, you know, I want to address your question before we go too far. Okay, Mike, my question, I hope it's clear. All right, now just to, you know, Doug, your question about this concept that Radvaz says that a person who's not Jewish can keep all the other laws if he wants for the perfecting aspect of them, not as a capacity of a command. So, but then he makes exception within the mezuzah, tefillin, and the Sefer Torah. So what he's saying is that since these things require a certain behavior, so like Rabbi Mann said, therefore it makes sense that if the Ben Noach has not been accustomed to this his entire life, so then he's not going to be able to relate to these things properly, and it could be a disrespect to these objects, which ultimately is a disrespect to God's name. So that to me is a good answer. I mean, it makes sense why he would say certain objects that have the highest level of sanctity because of God's name, so therefore you want to be careful that they are not abused in any way. And again, it's not a reflection on an individual Ben Noach who could be much more perfected than a specific Jew. It's just that you have to have standards of law. So I think his answer really covers it. I mean, is that satisfactory to you, Doug?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, yeah.
Rabbi?
Yes. I'm sorry, is that you, Kel?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead. I'll just follow your question.
Okay, well, I was just thinking, too, that the whole system of Torah seems to be designed on passing it down from one teacher to the student and then, all the way down. And a Gentile, unless he seeks out teaching to the Jewish community, does not have the background in that system in place to correctly interpret the Torah.
That's correct. Right.
Yes, Rabbi, one quick question on, I understand the concept, which is interesting. I've never heard it put this way before, that, if someone keeps mitzvahs for perfection, but not, is not commanded to, I think that's where the debate is, with the exception of these three, correct?
Yes.
To fill in, and what you've been discussing. When it comes to the laws of Shabbos, okay, how does that play into it as well? We know that if it comes to to Shabbos, a non-Jew, if he keeps Shabbos, cannot keep Shabbos the way the Jewish people keep Shabbos.
Yeah, he has to break one.
Is that kind of is that tied into the same idea where it's related more to perfection and not mitzvahs?
There, I believe the reason why the Sabbath can't be kept exactly like the Jew is because it would confuse the world as to who would be the correct teacher of Torah. If the Gentile was keeping the Sabbath just like the Jew, so Maimonides says one of the reasons why we keep the Sabbath is for bodily rest. Another reason is because it gives the opportunity of the Gentile to look at the Jew as different and inquire to this behavior. Why are you not working when the rest of the world is? And this now gives the Jew the opportunity to respond back to the Gentile and explain that we are mimicking the Creator who rested on the seventh day. So the whole purpose of the rest, of the inactivity on this one day a week, is to attract attention from the rest of the world, that would commence a dialogue between the Gentiles' question and the Jews' response. And in this fashion, the Jew would be able to educate the Gentiles on God of creation, and then whatever following dialogues ensue about all the rest of, you know, the God's actions and his will for man. So, but if we would, if you know, the Gentile and the Jew were both keeping the Sabbath, so then some Gentile would see somebody not working, he'd go over to him and ask him, and if that was a Ben Noach who doesn't have he's not as well versed, because he's not commanded in the entire succession of the 13 laws, so he's not typically as well versed and diligent with his study, because the Jew has to practice it. So he's diligent in the study, and he makes sure he understands exactly how to perform the laws. So he knows much more about the Torah than the typical Ben Noach. So to ensure that the Torah is transmitted properly, intact, so the Gentile is not allowed to act as the Jew does on the Sabbath. That's my understanding of why it is that he can't keep the Sabbath. The perfection, of course, is there, and he can keep a lot of it, you know, I believe as long as he breaks one thing, so he's not keeping the Sabbath intact. I mean, you'll tell me if that's what your teachers have told you. Is that what you learned, Doug, Cal?
Yes, and that the whole idea of Shabbos was something given to the Jewish people, very specifically. Rabbi Chait did a series on this, and I've been away from it a little bit, but that particular mitzvah is specifically for the Jewish people, and so it doesn't even make sense for Gentiles to try to come along and keep it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Right, so there evidently seems to be it's for the role. It's basically for the role of the Jew. And it makes sense because the role of the Jew ultimately is the educator of the Torah. And you want to keep that, you know, undiluted, I guess is the best way. Okay. All right.
I presume, Rabbi, that you wouldn't extrapolate beyond that it's forbidden for a Noahide to teach other Noahides about Torah.
No. I mean, it says that the Gentile, the Noahide, that studies his laws is like a high priest. And I can't see that there would be a prohibition for him to teach us his son. Okay, and Alberto, I'm not sure what you're asking. If you just elaborate on the screen what you're writing, you're saying why the rabbis impute death penalty over this possibility. I'm not sure what you're referring to. Okay. Now, let's just take a look and see what we've... all right. Now, that's all in terms of the creation of the, you know, tefillin and so on and so forth. What we were reading, that it has to be written a certain way. All right. Yeah, let me just want to see the other laws. Give me one second. Okay, he talks about in law, in tefillin, chapter 3, law 16, tefillin can only be made by a Jew because its making is like its writing. Meaning clearly, since the writing has to have the right intent, and that's something which, since the Jew has been accustomed to all the laws and has the right concepts, so when he writes God's name, it's going to be proper. So also, even you might think, well, maybe that's only in terms of writing the text, but what about creating the leather of the tefillin and forming it into the square boxes and making them black? So he says even that only can be done by a Jew. He says, but the reasoning is because of the letter shin that is carved into the boxes. And the letter Shin, even though it's not written with ink and it's a carved process or a molding process, but still, since it forms the exact structural letter Shin, it's a Hebrew letter, the second to the last letter, so, and that's the beginning of God's name, Shakai, or Dai, actually. One of God's names is Sheh, and then Dai, which means that it is sufficient, that He is sufficient. So the tefillin actually have the shin letter in the box on the head. The dalad is created by the knot in the back of the head and the straps. And then the yud letter, the third letter in that series, is in the knot on the arm, the tefillin of the arm. All right, so that's in terms of the creation of it. Let's just see. He also talks about the tefillin require the person's body to be pure. And you have to be, this again is something which the Jews can be more used to because of all the laws about purity and behavior and modesty. There are many different laws that the Torah has that target this type of, you know, cleanliness, washing hands before prayer. So he says, because the tefillin require a clean physical body, this could be another reason why the Radvaz is saying that he doesn't feel that it's fit to allow Benoach to follow this. Let's see, what other ones? What other law would define? You have two things we covered.
Well, can I ask a quick question that I know you can give me a quick answer to? When it comes to Mishneh Torah, a Hebrew English version, can you recommend a publisher or something that you think is more user friendly?
I'll have to look into that.
Okay.
Let me just take a look. Alberto had a question over here. I think no, they're just having a conversation themselves. Okay, it's not towards me. All right. Like I said, we've shown that there's the... since these objects are different in terms that they have God's name, so we could understand a little more why the Radvaz was more strict in terms of Benoach following these three, since they have to be treated a certain way. And we see itself that even the creation of them has certain individuals that are fit and are unfit to actually create it, because the object itself is the level of importance comes from the fact that it includes God's name, and therefore it requires the correct concept of God. We don't just say that God's name, when it's written, has a certain status. No, if it's written by a heretic, it's not God's name, and we actually have to destroy it. Okay, so that is, we went through a little quickly, but it is, you know, an interesting idea, this whole concept that the tefillin, the mezuzah, and the Sefer Torah, that it's not simply the physical object. It is the idea that's connected to it. So it gives us, you know, a little peek into, you know, what is really more important in our lives. It shares that notion about, you know, that the physical is far surpassed by the world of the spiritual. So you can have two identical objects, two identical Sefer Torahs. They look the same, exactly. One is a Sefer Torah, and one is not a Torah. That all has to do with having the right concept. So we see that it's more than, see another object, say for example like a menorah, right, or an esrog, things that other objects of Jewish law, other objects of mitzvah, so they aren't on that same level because they aren't an object of intelligent writing. See, when something is written, when you have an object that has writing in it, now it's pointing to ideas. There's communication here, there's transmission of Torah. These are things that transmit ideas more than, let's say, a fruit. On the holiday of Sukkot, we have to take the citron. So, but that's something which is a lesser level, even though it's an object of mitzvah. And then, let's say, for example, an olive is nothing. There's no laws that deal with an olive. I mean, you have olive oil that's used in the sacrifices, but the olive per se is not an object of a mitzvah. So therefore, it doesn't have that status. When something is communicating ideas, and certainly when it has God's name, so now we have to recognize why we have to treat it with a higher regard. Right? So I just want to make sure that that's clear, because that's the real distinction of these three objects. And therefore, we want to make sure that they're treated properly, so only those people that are used to all these other areas, where it's washing their hands in a certain way when you go to the bathroom, and all the other laws that govern and ensure a certain purity physically, a certain purity of thought, and a certain sanctity, meaning eating kosher, these are all things which render the person much more refined, and his emotions are much more restricted, and therefore the intelligence is much more free. So you have to appreciate that the more a person's in control of the emotions, because he has more commands, that's how much more his intelligence now runs his life, and how much more crystallized his ideas can be, because it's not diluted with emotional pull. So therefore, what he creates is going to be more of a pure form in terms of God's name when he writes things, and the way he relates to objects that have God's name on it, he's going to relate in a better way. So therefore, these objects, the tefillin, the mezuzah, and the Sefer Torah, the Radvaz wants to say, these should be restricted and not left to a Gentile to follow these laws because of those reasons. And again, it's not because the Gentile has any less capacity to do it than a Jew. It's just that when you make a Torah system, you must have standards, and therefore general rules apply. In general, the person who's not keeping the 613 commands is not going to be on a higher level of regard. He will not be able to display a higher level of regard for these objects as a Jew. The Jew who's keeping these 613 is much more aware of all the considerations, and he can treat these objects with much more care. But that's, again, these are only general rules. Okay. Let me see. Alberto is writing something. Okay, he's writing it to another person online. Okay, very good. Okay, let me stop here and see if there's any questions or comments at this point.
Thank you for discussing this. This is very illuminating.
Yeah, it was for me too. It definitely was very, I was going through it this week. Doug had the question last week, and I was thinking about it. and I brought it up, I was discussing with Rabbi Reuven Mann over at this past Shabbos. And just going through the Rambam's words, Maimonides' words, he is par excellence. So in terms of his codification of law, and you could study him. It's just amazing how much he wrote, the volumes that he wrote, but without lacking any type of, even though he wrote a lot, you think sometimes people are, the person can be a little careless. He wrote with such brevity and precision, and in a way that it points you to think, just like the Torah. He used the same style as the Torah that God wrote. That, of course, he's man, he's nowhere near God, but he saw the style, and then he wrote in a way where you have to stop and think. And you can derive ideas from how he's writing something, the order of his writing it, the grouping of his laws. So it's really, and then you start going through this and you see all the things he's saying here, you start coming away with real appreciation for what the Radvaz wrote and why he said what he said. And then you start seeing different categories of mitzvah. something that has God's name, and why is it that we have to treat it in a certain way? So it's for us, because when we treat something in a higher regard, that means if the Torah tells us, like for example, the temple cannot be entered by anybody, and at any time, and in any location, there's a tremendous amount of laws as to who can go where, when, why, what times of the year. The reason for this is because, just like if the White House, you're allowed to walk right into the Oval Office and, you know, see the president, it wouldn't have the same type of a veneer. It wouldn't have the same type of aura that it does, because there's a tremendous amount of security. So when you have a geographical location limited in terms of access, this creates a higher regard. And that's for us. Oh, so we must now pay respect. The president's office is important. The temple, where all the seat of the Jewish judges. This is where Torah emanates. So we have to have a high regard. It's not just that we have to follow the system and follow the laws, but it's important that we relate to certain people with respect and certain places with respect, because since the human mind is so multifaceted and there's so many emotions that we have, so God knows how to address. That's why there's so many laws, because there's so many angles that have to be addressed in man, in order that everything is being is creating. It's after years of study and keeping the laws, it refines a person in so many areas of his emotions. Okay, Joshua in Indiana has a question. Let me just read. He says, concerning blessings, Rambam says that the convert does not say, quote, who has sanctified us with his commandments and commanded. And okay, that makes sense, because the Gentile, the Benoach, is not commanded. Okay. He doesn't say those words, the quote that was commanded us, until after he immerses and converts, because he's neither commanded nor sanctified into that time. Okay, that makes sense. But Rambam also says that the wording of the blessing should not be changed. Okay, what do you think about Noachite saying certain blessings in the Seder, but substituting words like saying Israel instead of us? All right, it could be a good answer, but I have to look into that. Okay, Joshua, I don't want to give tell you what to do practically until something I'm 100% accurate, and you know, I speak to people that give actually something. See, somebody called a posek, somebody who gives out rulings, is not, I am not a rabbi in that respect. I can, if I go through the area, and I am satisfied that I now have covered all the content. What you're asking is something which I didn't cover yet, so I would, you know, defer to first of all, greater minds, and also, you know, rabbis that have addressed this in the past and have the all the rulings on their fingertips. So if you want to send an email in, just to remind me, I'll look into that for you. Let me just see if there's any other questions here.
Hey, Rabbi, can you tell me what your email address is?
Yeah, you can send it to office@mesora.org. office@mesora.org.
No H on the end of Mesora, just A?
Yes. No H. Okay. All right. Any other questions or comments before we wrap it up for today?
None here. Thank you, Rabbi. This is really enlightening.
Very good.
Very good. Thank you.
Very good.
So much.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
You have a good week. Safe week.
Yes, I look forward to it. You too. Me too.
And we'll speak to you next Sunday.
Yep, we're on for next Sunday. I'll try to give you a heads up as to what we'll do. I'll see if there's any more that I come up with on this, because again, you know, we just went through Maimonides. You know, just a few points in here, but there may be more in terms of where he's going here. Actually, I was discussing with Rabbi Mann about, since his last week's parsha was dealing with bad evil speech, which was Lashon Hara, and the plague of leprosy, and there is an interesting, if you want to take a look at the last few, or the last law that Maimonides has in his laws of leprosy, a very interesting philosophy. And this coming week, we have the two parshas coming up, a tremendous amount of philosophy, because the Achrimos and Kedoshim, so they deal, like I think the rabbi said, in Parshas Kedoshim, it has most of the fundamentals of Torah are in this parsha. So I'm glad it's only Sunday, and we've got time to look through until next week. We've got a full 7 days to look through. So, and if you want to look through it as well, you know, in Parshas Kedoshim, and like the Talmud says, there's one view that even Ben Noach is warned on observing any of these practices of witchcraft. So if you want to take a look at magic, but witchcraft is what the Talmud says. And I believe that's on, it's Talmud Sanhedrin 56b, I believe. It's around there. I'm pretty sure, 95% sure that's where it is. Right at the top, 56b, Talmud Sanhedrin, you'll see a view there that says that the Noahide is warned even on doing any of those, meaning there are different views in the Talmud as to what a Noahide can and cannot do. And that is interesting, that one view there. And there's another we talked about last week, I think, about castration of animals and mixed breeding of species of plants or animals. Okay, Rebecca.
Is the parsha next week? Is the double parsha?
Yes, it is. It's double next week.
Oh.
Let me see. Okay, Rebecca in Seattle, you're welcome. I'm glad you joined. We'll continue next week, 11:15. New York Times. Alberto is saying a question here. He asks, Gentiles must develop their own legal system as the rabbis did in the Talmud, since the Noahide laws are not completely developed. No, the Gentiles follow the system that of the Noahides. They don't develop their own legal system, but they have to have courts to enforce. Right? They have to have, according to a view, you must have courts to enforce the Noahide laws. Okay. Let's see if there's any other questions. Okay. Let's see. Okay, so what was I saying? Yeah, so maybe you'll take a look at that. We could address that. I've always found it very interesting, you know, about addressing the very different areas of witchcraft, speaking to the dead, everything that goes along with that. Warlocks, all the different things, drinking blood, and you know, where this comes from and why these things. It's really important to expose that there's nothing to these things at all, because this is very popular in today's culture, you know, horoscopes, and all these different things, TV shows where they have people supposedly speaking to the dead, you know, just these money machines that they prey on people's, you know, dire wish to speak to dead relatives that they love, and they just tease people and make these lies up, and it's important to really see that there is nothing to these things at all. Like Ibn Ezra says, the reason why these things are prohibited is because they're false. The Torah does not prohibit something which is true, because Ibn Ezra was saying some Jews, I believe he was talking about, some Jews believed that the reason these things really do work, but the Torah says you can't do them. So Ibn Ezra says no. I think he calls these people empty brain people. You see how passionate the rabbis were about making sure that nobody misconstrued what they were saying. And he says, no, that's an empty brained approach to think that the Torah is telling you that you shouldn't do something if it's true. No, the Torah says if something's true, you do it. It's that which is not true which the Torah prohibits. Right, so it's really essential. So that's next week's parsha. So maybe what we'll do is take a look at that a bit. Maybe we'll look into that for next week, and we'll take. There's a lot to do, so you know, we'll take it week by week.
That was very good.
All right, but if there's any questions you have during the week, email, you know, send them in, and be more than glad to respond even during the week. Right, we don't have to wait till next week to be in touch. And so, you know, feel free to do so, all right?
Will do.
All right, and if anybody missed any of the class that we did today, again, this is recorded. Everything we do today is recorded, and it will be put online. So within a half an hour after we wrapped up, probably within 15 minutes, it should be up live on the new postings and also the audio. But the new posting is easy to find because it's right at the top of the list for April. So if you want to see, you know, where the file is and play it from the beginning, it'll be there if anybody missed anything.
Yeah, that's the Yeshiva B'nai Torah?
No, that's the Mesora website.
Mesora.
Yeah, MESORA.org.
Okay.
Okay. All right. If anybody's in the any emails, you can send an email to office@mesora. All right. So this office@mesora.org. All right. So wish everybody a good week. Stay in touch. Any questions? Feel free to email during the week. All right.
Great. You have a great week too, Rabbi.
You too. Good to speak to you all.
Great.
Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, that'll wrap up today's class. We'll continue next week, same time, 11:15 a.m. New York time. And I wish everybody a good week. Hope everybody enjoys.